friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest this hour is formerly known as Anonymous. We now know that his name is Michael Scheuer. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's a recently retired CIA analyst of 22 years. He served in the Bin Laden unit, otherwise known as Alex Station, between 1996 and 1999. As Anonymous, he's published two books, Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama Bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America, and Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. Welcome to the show, Mr. Scheuer.
Thank you very kindly, sir. It's very kind of you to have me.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Exactly right, Scheuer.
Okay, great. All right, now I'd like to start this interview, sir, by reading a quote from your book. This is from page 15 of the introduction here. As I complete this book, U.S., British, and other coalition forces are trying to govern apparently ungovernable post-war states in Afghanistan and Iraq, while simultaneously fighting growing Islamist insurgencies in each, a state of affairs our leaders call victory. In conducting these activities and the conventional military campaigns preceding them, U.S. forces and policies are completing the radicalization of the Islamic world, something Osama bin Laden has been trying to do with substantial but incomplete success since the early 1990s. As a result, I think it is fair to conclude that the United States of America remains bin Laden's only indispensable ally. End quote. Indispensable ally, Mr. Scheuer?
I think so, and not intentionally. And let me make clear at the beginning of our conversation, sir, that this is not my book is not a blame America book. My book is meant to point out, or at least try to point out, the motivations of our enemy. And unfortunately for America, the main motivation of bin Laden and the increasing number of Muslims who support what he believes, which is a far larger number than the number that have actually picked up guns so far, are our foreign policies in the Islamic world. Policies which many Muslims regard as an attack on their religion, on their civilization, and at the most basic level, on their God. And my argument in the book is simply that in order to defend America better and to ultimately emerge victorious, we better understand the motivation of our enemy.
An ongoing theme throughout the book is that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda are not terrorists, but insurgents. So what is the point that you're trying to make there?
The point I'm trying to make is that the mindset with which Mr. Clinton's administration and now Mr. Bush's administrations have approached this problem is that bin Laden and his organization are nothing much more than a traditional terrorist group of the type we faced since the middle 1970s, with the only exception being that they're more lethal. And as a result of that, they've approached the problem primarily through law enforcement and intelligence operations, with the president, both presidents saying, for example, that we're going to arrest these people one person at a time until we put them out of business. Al-Qaeda, bin Laden formed Al-Qaeda on the basis of or on the model of the Afghan insurgent groups that fought the Soviets in the 1980s. And the organization itself is far larger, far better organized and trained, and far more talented than any terrorist type of organization we've ever encountered before. And so to depend on arresting these people one at a time to destroy our enemy is a tact that will not work.
All right. Well, we're about to go out to break here, but, I'll save my question until we get back. It's Mike Scheuer, author of Imperial Hubris, on the Weekend Interview Show.
Take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Michael Scheuer, formerly known as Anonymous. And he's the author of a great book. I just finished it this morning. Incredible read, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. Now, before the break, sir, you were saying that it's a mistake on the part of the last and the current administration to treat bin Laden and his group, Al-Qaeda, as criminals and hunt them down one by one and try them in court and that kind of thing. But isn't that what Dick Cheney always says, that that's the lesson we've learned, is that this is not police work, that we have to use our military to stop these people?
Well, the difference between their rhetoric and their actions, I think, is really quite phenomenal. You know, the main claim to achievement so far has been about achievement so far has been that we've destroyed or captured two-thirds of al-Qaeda's leadership since 9/11. And that is a great-sounding piece of information, and in fact, it's true. We've killed two-thirds of the leadership that we knew of on 9/11. Unfortunately, one of the people we didn't know was among the leadership at that time was a fellow named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who ran the operation. And in addition, both Vice President Cheney and President Clinton and President Bush all have treated al-Qaeda as if it is a static organization, in the sense that it is not a growing, dynamic organization. And the one thing we know about al-Qaeda is, because it's an insurgent group, it always plans on fighting a much more powerful enemy. And because of that, they put tremendous planning and preparation into succession. They expect to lose leaders. And we've seen, and the information is readily available in the press, every time that America scores a success, and they're important successes, in taking out one of al-Qaeda's leaders, within a day or two, al-Qaeda has named someone to take his place. And the person who takes the lost officer's place is always an understudy, someone who has been preparing to take that job on the assumption that his commander was going to be sooner or later eliminated from the scene. So what we really have at the moment, sir, is a body count. We really don't have a measure or a metric to use in terms of how much real progress we've made against al-Qaeda as an organization.
In fact, that's even the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld's words, right? We lack the metrics that we would need to measure success.
He did write what I thought was probably the most insightful memo or words that I have seen in the discussion of the war against al-Qaeda so far. And I live in hope of them trying to actually come to grips with determining a metric we could use to first estimate the size of the organization and then measure our progress against it.
And at this point, there are no metrics either in the Department of Defense or even in your own mind, a definitive way to measure progress.
Well, there is a way to measure. It's a very time-exacting or a time-consuming process, but the first thing that needs to change is kind of the mindset in the American intelligence community. When we have looked over the years at terrorist groups, we have primarily looked at their leadership and drawn up a table of leadership organization and measured our progress by clicking off each member of that group, each leader of the group that was taken out of action. We've not done an order of battle, if you will, of terrorist groups. And because of that, and because we still classify al-Qaeda as a terrorist group, we have not done an order of battle, similar to something we would have done against the Soviet Union in terms of their military. So you know exactly how large the military is or the enemy is, and you can measure the effectiveness of your attacks on it. One of the great tragedies of Guantanamo Bay, for example, is that most of the men who were arrested and taken to Guantanamo Bay were insurgent fighters and not terrorists. And for the first time, we would have had a closed community of people we could have questioned about organization, training, weaponry, and then the rest of the things that go into forming an order of battle. And instead, we treated them as if they were cognizant of plans to conduct another 9/11 attack. So we're still pretty much shooting in the dark in terms of estimating how much damage we have inflicted.
Well, and the purpose of this book really is to, I guess, in a broad sense, to clear up misunderstandings, to kind of an attempt to get the American people sort of on the same page with a realistic outlook about what we're facing, as opposed to the myths that we're kind of force-fed by the television. And this kind of goes back to the question of terrorist group versus insurgency. What kind of man is bin Laden himself, and what exactly are his objectives? You make a big point in your book of explaining that this guy is not Lex Luthor, the criminal mastermind who just wants to hurt people. He has a specific set of objectives he's trying to accomplish here.
Yes, sir. I think we're very fortunate in two things, that bin Laden has been interviewed by dozens of correspondents over the years, both Muslim and Western, so we have applied both cultural lenses to the man. And it seems to me that, that there is a great congruity in the reporting of these individuals, that bin Laden is what he seems to be, a man who is a pious and devout Muslim, a man who treasures his family, a combat veteran who's been thrice wounded and perhaps four times wounded, a man of great eloquence and of an implacable enemy of the United States. And the second point that has allowed us to understand bin Laden is his rhetoric. There is a corpus of readable materials now that is quite large, and when you read them, you come away, you have to come away, I think, with the idea that he is a dangerous enemy, but not a crazy man, and all the more dangerous because he's a rational actor. And I believe part of the genius of bin Laden has been to avoid trying to focus the Muslim world's anger against the attributes of American society, whether it's elections or liberties or gender equality or any of the sort of amorphous ideas that Americans that are part of the American lifestyle. You saw the Iranians under Ayatollah Khomeini rant and rave about those kinds of what the Ayatollah described as the debauchery of American society. And very, very few Muslims were willing to die for those types of goals to eradicate our way of life. Bin Laden, on the other hand, has focused on specific U.S. foreign policies in the Islamic world, policies which are clearly visible in terms of not only the president's, all of our president's words in support of those policies, but the effect of those policies on the ground in the Middle East on a day-to-day basis. So what we have is a man who is, even though we're very unwilling to admit it, a man who is a considerably important leader in the Islamic world and indeed the only hero in the Islamic world at the moment, and a man who has been very talented in finding issues which anger in Muslims and for which they are willing to die. So I think there's a great difference that has gone unnoticed by the American people, because our presidents keep arguing that they hate our liberties and they hate our freedoms, when that's not at all the case. And both books are really designed to explain to Americans that this is an enemy we must defeat. But we can't we cannot begin to defeat him until we understand the motivation he has.
And in your book, you list six main points.
Yes, sir.
Of American intervention in that part of the world that he's trying to undo.
Yes.
You want me to read through the list, or would
or
you
I can
to...
I can very simply give it.
Okay.
It's he focuses on, as you said, on six items since 1996. Very. Consistently, he'd be a great American politician in the sense that he stays on message. The six items are very quickly our unqualified support for Israel, our ability to press Arab oil producers to keep prices at levels acceptable to Western consumers, our presence on the Arabian Peninsula, our military activities in other Muslim countries, Yemen, and now Iraq and Afghanistan, the Muslim island of Mindanao in the Philippines, our support for governments that are viewed in the Muslim world as oppressing Muslims, the Russians in Chechnya, the Chinese in Western China, and the Indians in Kashmir, for example. And finally, and I think at bottom most importantly, our support for tyrannies across the Arab world. the Al Sauds in Saudi Arabia, President Mubarak in Egypt, the military government in Algeria. Those are the issues that bin Laden has focused on, and those are the issues which are motivating people to rally to his outlook or his philosophy.
Interestingly, the hijackers were not from the quote-unquote rogue states, Iran, Iraq, Syria. They were from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Yemen, countries with friendly governments.
Well, officially friendly governments, yes, sir. And that should reinforce a couple of things, I believe, that American policymaker is still awfully focused on state sponsors of terrorism, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. And while those are very dangerous states, they at least are states which, if they attack us, provide the American military an easy target to respond to. We know where they live. But Al-Qaeda has no fixed address, and it does draw Muslims from all over the Muslim world, all over the world. Wherever there's a Sunni Muslim population, Al-Qaeda is drawing support. And the one point I would make about Saudi Arabia is that Osama bin Laden is not, in terms of Saudi society, an aberrant or a deviant personality. Osama bin Laden is really the poster boy for the Saudi educational system. And he's the type of person that they have tried to produce over the past 30 or 40 years.
Hold it right there. We'll be right back with Mike Scheuer. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, the guest. Formerly known as Anonymous, now known as Michael Scheuer, author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. And, sir, right before the break there, you're talking about the educational system in Saudi Arabia and how Osama bin Laden is not really the fringe. He's exactly the product that Saudi schools turn out and has massive support all across the Middle East.
Yes, I think that the one thing we underestimate greatly is how popular he is in the Middle East as a leader and as a hero.
He's portrayed on TV here mostly as being sort of the lunatic fringe that nobody pays any attention to. He kind of makes the rest of the Muslim world look bad and that kind of thing.
Yes, sir. That is the image that our leaders have very much intended to give to the American people. And it's wrong and it's dangerous. We don't need to respect Osama bin Laden or empathize with him or think he's a good guy, but we certainly need to understand the power he exerts among Muslims around the world. And, you know, it sounds a little flip, but while you can't find a I Love President Mubarak t-shirt or a I Love the Al Sauds bumper sticker, across the Islamic world there are t-shirts with a bin Laden's picture on them. There is in Europe a cologne that's called Osama bin Laden cologne. There is there are candies that are wrapped in wrappers of Osama bin Laden's picture. And this is not in just traditional Middle Eastern areas. This is in the Philippines and in Senegal and in Sierra Leone and in Baltimore and Detroit, for that matter. And so it's a very dangerous thing to think that bin Laden is somehow an isolated figure in the Islamic world.
Forgive me, but in a way you almost sound like, or at least your argument perhaps could be used by the hardcore warmongers on the right to say, see, the enemy is Islam, just like Jerry Falwell says.
Well, I think that would be a very much a mistake, because it's not the Islam. I think it's fair to say that an increasing number of Muslims are attacking us, and they're attacking us because of our policy. They're not attacking us because Islam is a vicious, barbaric religion, but they're attacking us because of their perception of U.S. policy. And as in so many cases in life, perception is reality. And until we appreciate what our enemy believes, again, it's not, and I hate to be repetitive, but the enemy is motivated by what we do rather than what we are. And if we're going to defeat him, we need to understand that.
Let's see. I can go a few different directions from here. Well, let's get back to this, to the idea that this is a war, that these acts are not criminal acts. This is a war, and it must be managed with military force. Now, throughout your book, you argue basically that we need to stop these policies that are enraging bin Laden, our troops on the Saudi Peninsula, our support for Israel, etc. But I wonder, so if the solution is not police work, and the solution is not global democratic revolution, in the words of our president, then what exactly is the solution to this problem?
I think there are three solutions, really, or three parts of a solution. And the first one is simply to recognize why we're at war. And we're at war because of policy and not because of society or beliefs. The second point I would make is that we have not intimidated the enemy in any sense with our military power. We attacked in Afghanistan and won the cities, but stopped there. Basically, most of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban went home with their guns and are now coming back onto the scene in an insurgency that appears to be slowly accelerating. Obviously, in Iraq, we let nearly 500,000 Iraqis go home with their guns and are now facing the consequences of that decision. In many ways, one of the big problems America has is it has not been ruthless enough with its military. And our enemies in Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and Iraq have simply ducked down and then looked up and said, well, we just rode out two wars with the greatest power on the face of the earth, and we're still in business. So I think the American use of force, unfortunately, has to be more aggressive and much more lethal. We're fighting an enemy whose culture still has a great respect for force, and we've not impressed them. And the third component is I haven't really argued that our policies should be changed. What I've said in the book, and I think repeatedly, is that the policies bin Laden has identified have been in place for 25 years or more, almost on autopilot. And my own recommendation is simply more democracy. That we debate those policies, not to change them and certainly not to appease the enemy, but to determine whether all of them are still in the best interests of America. And if they are, then they should be kept. But if they're not, then maybe we should alter them in a way that better protects the United States. But again, I'm not a policymaker, and I don't have all the answers. But I think democracy within America is the answer to so many things that perhaps before we can wage a successful war, we need a debate on the policies that are motivating our enemy.
Well, it's interesting. You know, when the book came out, speaking of debate, I saw Newt Gingrich and everybody sitting around on Meet the Press, and they dismissed out of hand the idea that any of these policies were changed. So they just latched right onto, well, we're just going to have to wage total war then. And that's of great concern to me. I'll let you address that when we get back from this break. I'm Scott. It's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Mike Scheuer, formerly known as Anonymous, author of the book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Michael Scheuer. He's the author of the book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He's a former CIA analyst of 22 years, and commercials always come at the most inconvenient times around here. Before we went out to break, I was mentioning I saw Newt Gingrich and quite a few others. I think your former boss, James Woolsey, was on there with him. On Meet the Press, not too long after your book came out, and basically what was on the table was, you know, Mr. Scheuer here says we have a choice between war or total war, and to have just war, we would have to stop all of our policies in the Middle East that, as you say, have been ongoing for three decades or more, and Newt Gingrich and the rest of them just dismissed that idea completely out of hand. and went straight to the, you know what he says here, we're going to have to firebomb them like we did Tokyo and Dresden. And they just latch right onto the total war solution as though that's what you're advocating. Do you worry that you're helping to feed their fire?
It's a very worrisome thing. But at the same time, I worry about being misunderstood in the sense that there doesn't need to be an application of military power. I think part of our enemy is very irreconcilable and will have to be dealt with by the U.S. military and intelligence services. But, you know, Mr. Gingrich and others, Mr. Woolsey especially, are part of this breed of neoconservatives who I really don't understand completely, but they seem to specialize in assertion rather than analysis. And they to simply say that our policies are sacred and unchangeable as if they were written by the founders rather than by contemporary politicians, I think just ensures that we will fight. We don't have a choice, as you said, between war and peace. The choice is between war and endless war. And if we only have the military and the intelligence services to defend America, that will do for a while. They'll hold the ring. But I don't think it's possible to kill 1.3 billion Muslims, and surely it's not desirable. And so if we're going to be in a position where we can eventually slow the growth of support for bin Ladenism in the world, policy change and other sorts of non-military activities are going to have to complement military and intelligence operations. If not, then the only road ahead is a bloodbath. And to reject any sort of discussion or debate of policy is just consigning thousands and thousands of Americans to death, as well as an untold number of Muslims.
I read a great book called A Pretext for War by James Bamford, and I interviewed him here on this very radio show. And I guess the thing that stuck with me the most that I learned from that book, there's a couple of different quotes from Osama bin Laden and from, I forget his first name, Zawahiri.
Ayman.
Ayman Zawahiri, saying that September 11th was a trick. It was a trap to lure us into their sand pit where our guys are within their rifle range. That they didn't think they were going to scare us away. They knew that we were going to lash out, and that's what they wanted.
I disagree with some points in Mr. Bamford's book, but I think on that point he's exactly correct. Bin Laden, if you read his rhetoric and his interviews and speeches since 1996, has been very eager to get the American army and military to Afghanistan. And I remember DCI Tenet testified before the Congress that after 9/11, Bin Laden was surprised by the fact that we deployed to Afghanistan. And certainly nothing could be more false than that. He wanted us on the ground there, and I often think that when he gets up in the morning now, he must kind of bang his head against the wall because it took him the better part of a decade to get to Afghanistan, and now we're sitting in garrisons and not coming out where they can shoot us. So he clearly wanted us on his turf, but he really wanted to be able to do more damage than he's done so far to us.
I have a quote here from Zawahiri. I can't remember now if I got this out of your book or somewhere else, but he says, quote, "We thank God for appeasing us with the dilemma in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Americans are facing a dilemma in both countries. If they withdraw, they will lose everything. If they stay, they will continue to bleed to death."
Mr. Horton, I think that is the kind of quote that more Americans should read. To know what a calculating and indeed lethal enemy we're facing. Iraq, and I have to say for your listeners, I am no expert at all on Saddam Hussein or weapons of mass destruction or the threat that Saddam posed to America. But it's certainly a fact that there was no greater present on earth available to be presented to Osama bin Laden than the American invasion of Iraq. It validated so many of the things that he's claimed over the years. For example, our desire to control Arab oil, our intention to destroy any strong Arab government, our willingness to destroy any Muslim regime that threatened Israel. And more than that, Iraq is the second holiest place in Islam. And the The results of U.S. policies and actions now are that we occupy the three holiest places in Islam. They regard us as occupying the Arabian Peninsula, which is first. They regard the Israelis, who are interchangeable in the Muslim viewpoint with Americans, as occupying Jerusalem, which is the third holiest place. And now the American army occupies Iraq, the second holiest place. So as the result of the Iraqi invasion of Iraq, we have offended 1.3 billion Muslims because we occupy their sanctities. And whether or not they support or even can stand Osama bin Laden, they are mad at us.
You know, the thing that sticks out the most to me in this quote is, we thank God. Now, I don't even believe in God myself. I'm sort of an agnostic type, and I throw around language like that sometimes. But from what I gather in reading your book, and particularly, in fact, there's a military strategist named William S. Lind, who wrote an article with the same name as your first book, Through Our Enemy's Eyes. And he wrote about, after a bombing attack in Saudi Arabia, these al-Qaeda guys, I guess, were killed by the Saudi security forces, and they found their journals. And in William Lind, in describing the journal of one of these al-Qaeda guys, comments that it's like reading the Iliad. It's where Allah literally reaches down from heaven to help this guy out the window. And so I guess the point is, these people really believe that. They're not just saying we thank God. They really are thanking God.
Yes, sir. One of the greatest disservices American political leaders have done to their own, to our electorate, to our citizens, is to continue to insist that our enemy has no religious motivation, that it's somehow a perversion of their religion, and really nothing could be further than from the truth. The reason bin Laden has resonance in the Islamic world is because so many millions of Muslims regard our policy as an attack on their religion. It's really extraordinary that our leaders haven't been able to get a grip on that, especially the Bush administration, which is so heavily influenced by evangelicals. They ought to recognize the mobilizing power of a religion that perceives itself as under attack. And yet, there seems to be no sign over the past 15 years that political leaders on either side of the aisle are willing to even consider the idea of religious motivation on the enemy's part.
Especially considering it's the religious right in America who most strongly back this effort to export the separation of church and state to the other side of the world.
Yes. I often thought that if the research into our recent election, Mr. Horton, proves that the conservative Christian community delivered the election to Mr. Bush, it could only be explained that the evangelicals believed that their God and their faith were under attack by policies or proposed policies, whether it was gay marriage or homosexual rights or abortion. They were reacting to an attack on their religion by policy. It's not at all different than how Muslims react to our policy. The difference is, in America, we respond to that kind of an attack at the ballot box. In the Islamic world, traditionally, they rally together and use the force of arms to oppose such an enemy.
Well, can't we just spend a bunch of money on Madison Avenue and convince them that we mean well?
I think, unfortunately, sir, we're way past being able to talk ourselves out of this war.
Because I could swear, I just saw on MSNBC last week that if we only spend the right amount of money on the right kind of advertising campaign, then they'll understand. And that's the problem, is they don't understand.
Well, there's a tremendous mindset, at least here in Washington, that somehow we can convince these poor, unwashed Muslims that what we're doing is in their best interests. But it's really quite mad. One of the tragedies of the 9/11 Commission report is it puts so much emphasis on public diplomacy. The problem isn't that Muslims don't understand what we're doing. The problem is they believe they know what we're up to, they don't like it, and they're going to oppose it. America has frittered away all of the credit it has gained since the end of World War II as the killer of imperialism. You know, Roosevelt helped to force Churchill to dismantle the British Empire. Eisenhower stopped the Anglo-French Israelis at the Suez Canal, and Reagan armed the Mujahideen. All of that credit as anti-imperialist, as an anti-imperialist power has been frittered away over the past 15 years. No one in the Middle East gives us the benefit of the doubt.
You said earlier that the neocons seem to specialize in assertions rather than analysis, and although this really doesn't have anything specifically to do with your book, I know that at least this general area of Asia was part of your expertise while you still worked at CIA, and so I have to ask you, it's off topic and we can get back to the real topic in a minute, but before I forget, I really want to ask you whether you know of any evidence whatsoever to support our government's assertion that Iran is developing nuclear weapons.
I only know what I read in the paper, sir. As I tried to explain at the beginning of the program, my area of labor has been in the Sunni world. I have not worked on Iran. I have no reason to doubt that they're trying to develop those weapons, but I think the question always comes down to is what can they do with them if they have them? Do they have a delivery capability? How much of a threat is it really? And I'm not trying to duck the question, but all I could give you is speculation, not even informed speculation on this issue.
Okay, and to be fair, I threw that at you, or it was quite unfair for me to throw that at you. You don't make any reference to such things in your book, but it's just that the government keeps saying they're developing nuclear weapons, and yet the best I can tell, the entire international community says, no, they're in a state of complete cooperation with us, and they're not developing nuclear weapons at all. So I figured since you were CIA, maybe you knew.
Well, Mr. Horton, there's the one thing I would say about what appears to be the neoconservative agenda is that they're still locked in the Cold War mentality, in the sense that they don't see threats unless they're a threat from a nation state, and they don't really appreciate the threat that's posed by transnational threats in terms of bin Laden-type terrorism or counter-narcotics or organized crime. And so it seems to me what they intend to do, and it's probably simplistic, but this is what it seems, they're going to tick off each of the states that are on the state-sponsored list of terrorism, you know, Iraq, Syria, Iran, North Korea. And their conclusion is that if we do that, the problem is over. Well, if they do that, first of all, I don't think it's possible to do. But second, if they did it and were successful, they would find that bin Ladenism had only grown stronger.
Have you seen The Power of Nightmares? I was actually pretty convinced. I saw it, and they made a very compelling case that Al-Qaeda barely exists at all. They're a band of pirates you probably couldn't even fill a pirate ship with. And then I picked up your book, and it's got quite the opposite explanation in there.
Yes, sir, I did see the program, and you know, everyone has their interpretation, and everyone has their analysis. And I frankly can only speak to what I know. But over a course of following these people for 15 years, and really I think having a pretty good view of many sources of information, I think it's much more than just a nightmare. And in fact, the real problem is the way bin Laden has been described and Al-Qaeda have been described as by our political leaders. They're much more than just some kind of a nightmarish imaginary problem. They're a real threat. And with all respect for the people who presented that documentary, I think it is badly misleading.
All right, I can appreciate that. I'd like to bring up this. I read in The Atlantic a letter that you wrote to the United States Senate Subcommittee on something or other.
How not to
catch a terrorist. I'm sorry?
It was I sent the letter to both of the intelligence committees, sir.
Oh, I see, the intelligence committees. And basically, this is how not to catch a terrorist. 10 things that happened that led to the success of the September 11th attack on the part of Al-Qaeda. I'll just run through this list here real quick. If I can, maybe we can stop and elaborate on the more important ones. Mid-1996, bin Laden seeking a nuclear weapon, and this was suppressed by the bosses at CIA and took a tooth-and-nail fight to even get that information to decision-makers. December 1996, an intelligence community agency would not share intercept information with the CIA. And then when they began to, the military leaked it to the press, and that was the end of that. Much of the time, the military would not work with you at all, and the CIA bosses would not intervene to help. Oftentimes, or I guess for almost the entire time, you could only get summaries of intercepts of electronic communication rather than the actual transcripts. Tell the story of, in 1997, another agency was on the case of an Al-Qaeda plot, and their lead officer was sent home. And I wanted to ask you about this one. You seem to be implying that the Africa bombings was the immediate result of this agent being sent home. Were you referring to a different attack?
I'm afraid I don't have the copy of that directly in front of me, sir.
Okay.
If you could read just what I, if you have it there.
Oh,
if you could read
I actually it. Don't. I just have my notes of it in,
okay.
here in front of me. I'm sorry. It did seem to be implying that the attack that she was on the case of ended up being the Africa bombings.
Yes, that's exactly correct. We had an officer from the FBI who came to us a year earlier, and she had some knowledge of Africa, and she spent a full year preparing to support an operation we had been planning to stage in East Africa. And a few weeks before we were ready to conduct that operation, her superiors at the FBI called her back to work there.
Oh, we're out to go to break here. We'll be right back with Mike Scheuer, CIA. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. We're wrapping up with Mike Scheuer. He's the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. It's an excellent book. I finished reading it this morning, and I'll be thinking about it for weeks and weeks, to be sure. We're almost out of time here. Just have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you real quickly, why anonymous? And also, why did you quit the CIA, or were you fired? Because I remember reading a quote of you saying that you liked being an intel officer and you planned on being one for many years to come.
Yes, sir. Both books were I was anonymous on both books because the agency required me to be. Both of my manuscripts were submitted, as all agency officers have to submit manuscripts for review. Nothing was deleted or added or changed. But I was ordered, I was told basically, rather, that I could publish the works as long as I remained anonymous. And so it was not my choice to remain anonymous. And very nicely, when I resigned, the agency gave me permission to associate my name with the books. Several people had accused me of hiding behind anonymity, and so I'm much happier really being able to defend myself or accept responsibility for what I wrote.
Well, why did you resign if you wanted to stay on?
I resigned because the letter that I had sent that you quoted to the two committees of Congress was ignored. I truly believe that we've made a huge mistake in reorganizing the intelligence community without assessing the level and degree of personal accountability, personal negligence, and failure that led to 9/11. All of the items mentioned in your letter were brought to the attention of the very senior-most leaders of the intelligence community and were not acted on. These were problems that could have been fixed, and people just decided it was too bureaucratically hard or too expensive to fix them.
Right. For example, that there are fewer CIA operatives working the Bin Laden unit today than there were before September 11th. Might that be one of the problems?
Yes, or fewer experienced officers. The agency played a shell game with the American people in the sense that the number of officers working at 9/11 was kept, and then they said they doubled the number. Well, that's true, but what they did was they rotated people in every 60 or 90 days, and so the total productivity of the unit dropped because the veteran officers had to train the new ones. When the new ones were trained, they were moved out, and another group of new ones was brought in.
Mr. Short, I'm sorry, go ahead.
For that reason, I thought I had exhausted all of the appeals. I've been kind of doing this since 1999, saying we really need to fix these problems. The intelligence committees were my last resort, And when they ignored what I wrote, I thought it was best to resign and try to be a good citizen rather than just being a good employee.
Mr. Scheuer, last October, right before the election, Osama bin Laden put out another video. And, in fact, I read that entire transcript on this show. And he seemed basically to be trying to reposition himself as not even an insurgent leader, much less a terrorist leader, but as sort of a man of peace, and seemed to be offering at least a degree of truce with the United States. I wondered if you think that it's possible to strike a deal with bin Laden and end this conflict peacefully.
I'm not sure if that's possible, because I think bin Laden is to some extent irreconcilable, but right now it's not possible because America's leaders either do not recognize what the war is about or are lying to the electorate, and there's really no room for discussion at the moment. But in a larger sense, that message was the fourth in a series that spoke directly to the American people, saying, we know how your system works. Please elect leaders that will change your policy. And really, at the end of the day, I think that speech was the last time bin Laden was going to warn us. I think the next time he talks to the American people directly will be after another attack in the United States.
Michael Scheuer, he's the author of Imperial Hubris. Read it.